Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Our assumed way of sleeping is being heavily promoted now by the sleep industry. The sleep industry is now worth, you know, over $100 billion. So capitalism really is the driver behind this whole idea of you must sleep 7 to 8 uninterrupted hours. But it isn't the way that our ancestors slept, and it isn't the way that a lot of Indigenous people sleep.
I'm Sarah Wilson, and this is Wild, a show where we talk with the biggest minds in the world about the ideas that can help us love and save our one wild and precious life together on this planet.
I've been an insomniac for most of my life, and I've spent just as long trying to find various fixes and salves, drugs and techniques, as well as, when the fixes invariably fail, philosophical and spiritual perspectives for my inescapable, life-dominating predicament. In my book, First We Make the Beast Beautiful, I cover a number of these philosophical and spiritual perspectives. I found that insomniacs, for various reasons, often failed simply to learn how to self-soothe at night. And many theories speculate that insomnia is a cry from our core to spend reflective time with ourselves. Some of us, especially those of us who are perhaps more sensitive or have more active brains, need this extra space and time. As British philosopher Alain de Botton, who was a guest here on Wild a few months ago, puts it, it's an inarticulate, maddening, but ultimately healthy plea released by our core self that we confront the issues we've put off for too long. Insomnia isn't really to do with not being able to sleep. It's about not having given ourselves a chance to think. Alain argues that this need to reflect quietly, to reacquaint ourselves, without the distraction and obligations of our daylight selves, outweighs the benefits of sleep. And so we somehow subliminally make the call, think, not sleep. Now, my wild guest today had read my book, and she'd read about the theories I'd looked into, and it prompted her to reach out when she published her own book on the subject of insomnia, asking if I'd write a blurb for it, which I did, before suggesting she join us here on Wild to talk through the wonderfully rich, insightful content of her own book. Annabel Abbs is a British author and newspaper columnist whose new book, Sleepless, Unleashing the Subversive Power of the Night Self, won Times Book of the Week as soon as it hit shelves in the UK and received rave reviews around the world. The book tracks Annabel's own experience with insomnia, but also her journey to make peace with it, learning about its subversive power per the subtitle. Her deep research discovered a secret, dark, moonlit world of what she calls night spinners, creative women throughout history, from 15th century writers to 20th century astronomers and moth collectors, who thrived because of their sleeplessness. In this episode, we chat through this rebellious and freeing notion and the science behind why women in particular respond so creatively to being awake in the night, something I had not at all been aware of. She talks through the hormones that shift, what happens to our brains at this time in the 24-hour cycle, and how we can actually make powerful use of what is otherwise experienced as a distressing, frustrating awakeness. If you're insomniac, you will rejoice in this conversation and maybe even be shocked by it. And if you're not, I invite you to share it with someone who is. Okay, let's meet Annabel Abbs. Annabelle, thank you so much for joining me and all of us here on Wild. There is something about talking to a fellow insomniac. It's like talking to a hobbyist, right? So if you collected trains, you find somebody who collects trains as well. And all you want to do is talk about the particularities of their experience, because it can be a very lonely experience being an insomniac. So perhaps we could start with you explaining what kind of flavour of insomnia you have had over the years.
Well, over the years, it's changed quite a lot. So it kicked in when I was probably in my very early 30s. In fact, I think I might have been pregnant with my first child. Well, I'd had it before, actually. So whenever I was anxious about something, and this goes back a long way, I wouldn't sleep. So if I had an exam the next day or I had to give a talk the next day, I wouldn't sleep for the whole night. Then that sort of, I got used to exams and public speaking, and that sort of passed. Then I became pregnant and had children. Of course, then it came back because I was up a lot, either with leg cramps or feeding babies or ill kids. So that sort of set it off again. And then I just learned to live with it. And I referred to that phase as my sort of mild and manageable insomnia. I was just a little bit tired sometimes. Sometimes I had an afternoon nap, but it all seemed to work for me. And during that time, I was also writing at night, and I started to discover that an element to the night that I quite liked. But then I had a series of bereavements during COVID, and I lost several people. In fact, there were four. There was one that I didn't write about in the book because it was almost too awful. But these occurred in the space of 6 weeks. And I think when you have something of that scale that completely disrupts everything you ever thought, sends you into, you know, just a terrible, terrible place. You know, sleep is almost, well, I found it impossible. So then my insomnia ratcheted up to a whole new level of every single night and just not being able to sleep. And so that choice, it was like, do I take the sleeping pills, go to my doctor and get medicated, or do I just go with the insomnia? And I took the decision then that I would just embrace it and try and see what sort of a journey it was going to take me on. And I don't know if that sounds remotely familiar.
It sounds very familiar, because you eventually exhaust all routes, because none of them in fact work. They can work for a bit, and then, you know, the melatonin hits a point where it no longer works and you've got to take more and more of it. The, you know, the various medications and so on, it's the same thing. And you have to confront it in some form or another. What I love about your story is you decided to go down a rabbit hole of studying insomnia, but particularly focusing on the experiences of women who struggled with insomnia prior to the advent of all of these sleeping drugs and latex mattresses and pillows that you could go and order online. So I'm wondering, just to start with, could you explain whether women in particular suffer more insomnia?
Yeah, so the architecture of women's sleep, how we sleep, is quite different. And of course, this has not been studied very much, because most studies have been done on men, as we know. And it's only now really that the research community is starting to look at how women sleep. And the thing about women's sleep is that it seems to be more frail, slightly more fragile. We seem to have more micro arousals during the night. And insomnia is much higher amongst women than amongst men. And that's down to all sorts of reasons, partly hormonal. So if you look at puberty and sort of childbearing years and then menopause, our hormones are constantly changing. And some of those really do affect our sleep quite dramatically. But the other thing is that we suffer more from the things that often lead to insomnia. So anxiety and depression are much more prevalent amongst women. So it sort of stands to reason, really, that if we're suffering more from those, we're going to be suffering more from sleeplessness. So it is a particularly female condition, really.
Yeah. But the thing is, when you went and did this deep dive into the lives of women who existed from, you know, I think as early as the 13th century is as far back as you went in your studies, what you found is that far from creating just suffering, it also produced a very particular type of creativity. So you were looking at writers, poets, but also women who became scientists via their sleeplessness and what they were up to in the middle of the night. And I would love for you just to talk through some of your favourite examples of those creatives.
Yeah, so So for women, so before the advent of insomnia, which was first given the name, I think, sometime in the 19th century, before that, I think it was very, very normal for women to be awake during the night. It was just completely normal. There were no hospitals, so that caring for people during the night always fell to the women of the village and the town. So wherever you look in letters and journals, most of which are unpublished, some published, and memoirs, you will find these accounts of women just being awake. They're awake. They're often caring for people. They're often nursing and caring for often sick and tragically dying children, which, of course, was really, really common. So it's very, when you look through those records, it's very much a sense that women simply aren't sleeping. There's an awful lot of praying going on. So a lot of women would use the night for their sort of spiritual activity. But a lot of women also took that night to find something for themselves. So this was often studying, because women were not supposed to be studying. There's a great story about, which isn't in the book, about Mary Somerville, who's one of the earliest scientists. And she would study at night with candles. But as soon as her parents discovered that she was she was studying maths, they got rid of all the candles. They literally locked up all the candles so that she couldn't do that. So women were not supposed to be up at night. They were not supposed to be studying at day, during the day or the night. And also there was very little time for them to be creative. So many women used the nights to write, to draw, to paint, to embroider, just to snatch a bit of time for themselves. Because without that, there was nothing for themselves. The whole day was about caring for others and running the household and, you know, the food and gardening and just staying alive, really. So those seem to be the main elements. You're looking for creative time, looking for studying time, and looking for spiritual time. And that was where women found it. But actually, one of my favourite women, and she didn't get into the book, is a woman who was the very first sleep scientist. And she became a sleep scientist because she couldn't sleep. So I thought that was a wonderful example of how you can use the night and really lean into your sleeplessness to study it, because you are your own guinea pig. But there were many, many, many female astronomers. And back then, I mean, today's astronomy is done on laptops, but back then astronomy was done, you know, you were literally out in the garden or on the roof of your house, either with your naked eye or with your telescope. What they called it, sweeping, and you were sweeping the skies. So there's a tranche of women who were up all night sweeping the skies. But because they were women, they couldn't have a lie-in the next day. So they had to get up the next day and carry on with their usual, you know, housewifely chores. So I was intrigued by how they managed this, because they never talk in their diaries. They never talk about being tired. They never talk about having to have a nap or a lie down. They just seem to live with it in a way that I think we don't. We become really anxious about it. They just sucked it up. They were also much more comfortable in darkness.
That's a really interesting point. And I want to come back to that idea of the anxiety that comes about from thinking that we're meant to be asleep and then we don't sleep. Then that creates a stress which makes the experience of insomnia and certainly makes the way that you feel the next morning much, much worse. But let's stay in that realm of these incredible women who were doing things that they could not do during the day, and they were doing things that were nighttime things, like looking at stars and then becoming incredible astronomers. But also there were some painters. I think Jackson Pollock's wife would paint, you know, in the middle of the night. She was a chronic insomniac. I think she developed it in her early 50s, which suggests that it may have been related to perimenopause. But she had a very particular style of painting that she did not access during the day. It was her nighttime paintings also that she became very famous for. Could you talk through that? But I think also Sylvia Plath was very similar. She wrote a particular style of poetry that she didn't write during the day, and it became the far more fluid, expressive and open style of poetry that she then became very well known for. Yeah. I mean, that seems to be a bit of a thing, right?
Yeah, so I should probably just explain briefly about the prefrontal cortex, because when I started looking into this, I had a hunch that this seemed to be quite a female thing, the sense that you were accessing a part of your brain not normally available to you. Women talked about it. And men, who often also work at night, didn't talk about it. For men, it was just carrying on the work of the day, but doing it during the night. For women, it seemed to be as though they were moving into a different part of themselves that they weren't so familiar with and that was new to them in some way. So about that stage, I did start reaching out to the various neuroscientists and sleep researchers, trying to understand what was happening to the brain awake at night. So there have been very, very few studies of the brain awake at night, thousands of studies of the sleeping brain and the dreaming brain. So we sort of have quite a good idea of how that works now. But the brain awake at night when it should be asleep is still really understudied. And the first big study of it came out in 2 years ago, 2022. And it was called The Mind After Midnight. And that study was really pivotal for me because it sort of showed me that, this is going to sound dreadful, but it showed me that I was right. It showed me that my theory wasn't just mean. It wasn't just a sort of a vague sense of something might be going on. This bunch of researchers said, yes, the mind after midnight is very different. They didn't really drill down into the female brain, but they talked a lot about the prefrontal cortex, and that's the part of the brain that sits behind, up here, just behind the forehead. And it's the brain part that is probably the most sophisticated, the most evolved brain part. It helps us to keep all our emotions in check. It's very logical. It's very ordered. We can write lists. We can weigh up risk versus reward. You know, we can do all these complicated things that we're doing the whole time. You know, even when you go to the supermarket and you're thinking, should I buy these tomatoes or these? And your brain is looking at price and flavor and smell and all sorts of things, and thinking about what am I going to cook today and tomorrow. That bit of the brain seems to be larger and more active in women. So I thought this was really interesting because we also know that at night, the prefrontal cortex goes into partial hibernation. So it's been so busy working away all day, you know, doing all these tiny, tiny micro calculations constantly, that come the darkness, which also seems to be a sort of circadian prompt, that bit of the brain is like, okay, guys, I've got to go and get some rest. So that shuts down. And for women where that part of the brain is so in control during the day, that suggested to me that come darkness, come night, the freedom from having that dial down seemed to be more magnified. And these women would often talk about how Sylvia Plath talks really eloquently about how different her poetry is at night. And if you read her poetry that she wrote at night and you compare it to the poetry she wrote during the day, it's completely different. And these, of course, are the poems she's now most famous for. She's putting together words that you would never normally put together during the day because your brain is saying those words don't go together. You know, you can't put it like that. And in fact, I think for women, the prefrontal cortex, which is for everyone is quite judgmental, but for women, we have this learned response. We've been conditioned really to judge ourselves quite harshly. It's very important historically that we behaved ourselves, because if we didn't, we were thrown out. You know, so for women, we've always had to be, you know, really well behaved and behave properly. But when that bit of brain that's telling us, making sure we behave properly, when that shuts down, hey ho, you know, we really can start to work in a way where we're not judging what we've done the whole time constantly. So I'm sure you will be familiar with this, Sarah, because we're always judging ourselves.
Absolutely. It's really interesting, actually. I'm just thinking of the subtitle of your book, which is The Subversive Power of the Night Self. And there's obviously a sense of rebelliousness, a sense of sticking two fingers up to the daytime systems that you can feel locked into. And I think that that's something I'm familiar with. I know at night when I can't sleep and I get up and I do some writing, there's this really sort of freeing, sort of this ephemeral openness that I feel, a languidness where I'm able to access a sort of a type of humanity, if I can call it that, that doesn't feel constricted. I can really, really relate to this idea of that judgmental part of the brain shutting down. And I think I've got this right. I think I've read before that for men, when their prefrontal cortex shuts down at night, it actually leads to physical recklessness, which is why so many young men wind up in trouble, you know, whether they're driving a car too fast or committing crimes at night. But for women, it's the science, I think, suggests that we become less inhibited, but more so around this idea of creativity and allowing our imagination and our ideas to get very free. There's an example in the book, or a woman that you refer to who was a very early feminist, an Italian woman. Is it Laura Cicchetto? Have I got that pronunciation right?
So in Italy, they would call her Laura Ceretto. Yeah, we just say Laura Ceretto.
All right, Laura. Tell us Laura's story, because I like that one that sort of speaks to that subversiveness.
Yeah, I loved Laura's story, Laura, because she goes back so many years. So she was writing in about late 15th century. So this is a long time ago, and it's almost the first record we have of an insomniac woman who's actually written about her sleepless nights. She was an insomniac from a really young age, from about the age of 8, I think. And she was taught by the nuns in the convent where she was staying at the time. She was taught by the nuns how to use her sleepless nights. And in fact, in fairness, they didn't just tell her to pray to God. They said, get up and do something practical. And they taught her how to do embroidery. So she started by doing embroidery when she was 8. But as she got older, she decided that she could use these nights to study. And she would use, it sounds like the whole night. She might have slept for 1 or 2 hours. And she was studying, theology and astronomy and astrology and mathematics and philosophy. So she was there with a candle and all her books. But as these nights passed over weeks and years, she started to become really radical. And you have to remember, this is papal Italy. This is a very, very traditional time. And she starts to write about women and how women should be educated. Of course, no women were educated then. She started to write about the slavery of being a wife, and to question all of the roles that women were given. And she wrote this all up in a series of letters. And she would send these long letters out, which was how people communicated their ideas then, to other great thinkers, all male, other great thinkers of the day. And I really liked her because I thought that she had no education of her own. These were all her own ideas just coming to her in the middle of the night. And she talks about her rage. She talks about her night rage. And these were ideas that then, when I started looking at women sort of through the ages, these were very common ideas, this rage that we probably suppress during the day, seemed to be then sort of coming out. And in fact, anger has a sort of circadian pattern. So we're more likely to feel angry in the night. And in fact, Twitter outbursts or X outbursts of anger sort of peak at 2 a.m. apparently. It's partly to do, of course, with the prefrontal cortex. It's just stopping us from tamping down those sort of slightly aggressive emotions. But also, of course, at night, the darkness itself brings another element into play, because we are fundamentally frightened of the dark because we evolved to be diurnal. So the darkness itself is bringing a sort of a fear and a vigilance from the outside. So from the inside, we've got the prefrontal cortex not keeping things under control. And from the outside, we've got the darkness sort of pressing in and saying, you need to be really careful. This is a dangerous time. So this combined to make a lot of these, well, actually men and women, but particularly women, I think, to give them a really interesting, complicated set of moods and emotions to navigate during the night and to express during the night, because so many of them are, of course, writing and drawing. And I just quickly go back to Lee Krasner, because she, when her insomnia kicked in at about 51, she started off by walking her dogs. She thought Jackson Pollock's widow. She started off by walking her dogs, thinking, I'll just get all of this. And I suspect a lot of it was anger and frustration. She thought, I'll just walk it out. But the dog walking didn't work. She still couldn't go back to sleep. So she started painting. But her paintings were completely different from anything she had done before. And what I really liked about Lee Krasner, and she does talk about this in a couple of interviews, was that, well, the first thing she did was she took out all color. And she found that really freeing. She said, I no longer had to think about what colors I was going to use, because I only used, brown and cream. These were the sort of night colors. But she also talked about how she painted in a much more embodied way. And even the way she sort of took the brush to the canvas was completely different. She no longer stroked and dabbed. She thrust. And she talks in her interviews, she said, I don't know where it came from, but I was thrusting. And she's jumping because she starts painting enormous canvases. So most of us wake up in the night and we're a bit sleepy, aren't we? I just sort of potter around with my pencil. But, she's got her oil paints out and she's thrusting this brush and she's jumping. So she helped me think also there's a different way of being. We don't have to just sort of loll around feeling sleepy at night. We can just say, right, I'm going to be this really embodied night self and I'm just going to get on with it. And those are now her most valuable paintings.
Yeah, I listened to you speak about these women and how they're actually able to embody a part of themselves which becomes so important to their identity and to their legacy. And I have to say, it's a huge comfort. And I don't know if you're the same, Annabelle, but I wake up and then I feel I should be going back to sleep. I need to be, you know, quietening things down, don't turn lights on, you know, kind of scamper to the toilet, get straight back into bed and try to keep that vibe going. But learning about what you're talking about here is really freeing because it makes intuitive sense to me. My body needs to move when it gets up. And when I'm giving myself permission to do this, I get up and dance. I will actually do a form of sort of yoga and dancing. And it's almost an intuitive outlet, an expression that I need to do. But most of the time I stop myself from doing it. You know, I feel I shouldn't be doing this at night. I know that part of what you looked at was also this idea that sleeping an uninterrupted sleep for 7 or 8 hours is a very modern idea. In fact, our ancestors had a biphasal way of sleeping. It was actually quite common to wake up in the middle of the night, have some creative or, you know, or spiritual activity for a few hours and then go back for a second sleep. There are a bunch of things like that, aren't there, that you found that really throw a little bit of a bomb under our whole assumed way of sleeping today.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Our assumed way of sleeping, which is being heavily promoted now by the sleep industry and sleep scientists. The sleep industry is now worth, you know, over $100 billion. So there's a lot of money now vested in us sleeping in this sort of 7 to 8 hours, you know, in a straight line. And this really goes back to the Industrial Revolution. So if you go back 200 years, when factory owners and mill owners decided that they wanted everyone to come to work at the same time, to work when there was lots of natural light so they didn't have to spend money on lighting the place. And then they wanted everyone to go home, you know, late, obviously, but all at the same time, they would turn the factories would just go into silent mode. And they wanted everyone well slept so that the next day when everyone came back, they could be super productive. So capitalism really is the driver behind this whole idea of you must sleep 7 to 8 uninterrupted hours. But it isn't the way that our ancestors slept, and it isn't the way that a lot of indigenous people sleep. So I had lots of really interesting conversations with anthropologists. I remember one guy who had lived in the rainforest for about 12 years with a small community of indigenous people. And he said to me, you've got to understand how they slept because it's nothing like how we sleep. First of all, they all sleep together. So there's none of this just going into a room on your own. They all sleep together around a fire. And he slept like that too. And he said, the second thing is they're under a tent, but the sides are open so that anyone can wake up and look out and see the stars. And that seems to be a really, really important part of how they lived and slept. And he said that whenever he woke up, there were always, always a group of people, different people throughout the night, who were talking very sort of slowly, softly, quietly around the fire and having a cup of tea and smoking, whatever they were doing, pottering around. And he said, you know, so people, when you sleep, you're sleeping to the sound of a human voice, but not a panicked, anxious, angry one, but just these very quiet voices. So you get the sense that there's always someone sort of watching out, always someone awake. And I think that's perhaps one of the reasons that, you know, so many people say they fall asleep to an audiobook now. There's something about the human voice that's just so, so deeply restful. But he said it's quite normal. People just wake up, get up, do things, and then go back to sleep. And then people who had been up all night would, you know, they would have a little sleep in the afternoon the next day. So it was a much more flexible way of sleeping. And if you look back at the West pre-Industrial Revolution, and you look at the diaries of Samuel Pepys, for example, you will find that he is always getting up in the middle of the night. And sometimes he goes next door and has a cup of tea with a neighbor. Sometimes he goes and does some of his bookkeeping. So there was this sense that people slept in this sort of biphasic pattern in two chunks. And in fact, if you look at the Mediterranean, of course, until really recently, they had a much shorter night and then a long siesta. Although again, yeah, the global drive for productivity is really has pushed that out of the window so that even people in the Mediterranean can no longer have that siesta and that biphasic way of sleeping. We're all being channeled into this, you know, single way of sleep, which we're not necessarily suited to. And many of us, of course, are night owls, and some of us are sort of very extreme larks. So the fact that we all need to be at work at 9 o'clock, working through till 7 o'clock, in bed at 10 o'clock. it's treating us all as machines, and we're not machines.
Yeah, gosh, it really creates a sense of relief for me to hear all of that, because my body, I've always had the sense that my body knows what it's doing, staying awake. I've always had a sense that it's either some kind of real deep need to do some processing, either consciously or subconsciously, you know, emotionally or intellectually, or it's been a need for my body to move. You know, as I said before, it needs to get up and actually express and stretch and be alive and have oxygen going through it. And it's a drive in me, which I've never understood, and I felt that it's problematic. But now hearing you speak, I suspect that my body is responding to evolutionary cues. You know, we spent many tens of, you know, hundreds of thousands of years behaving differently, and now we're expected to work to a particular time frame, a clock, a capitalist-driven clock. You've touched on a couple of biological factors here. You've touched on the prefrontal cortex and how that operates at night. But there's a few other factors at play here. There's hormones, for instance. And for women in particular, the hormones operate differently at different times of the day. Can you talk through how that comes into play with insomnia?
I think it depends where you are in the sort of the female life cycle. So the hormones are constantly changing. Although interestingly, you talked earlier about men awake at night more likely to take risks, and that's partly also because testosterone rises and peaks in the middle of the night. We have less of it typically, but and so men are more I mean, really men should be asleep all night and we should be up and about
with the doors locked.
And in fact the latest studies show that women need complete darkness at night, or as dark as we can possibly get it. So women seem to be more susceptible to the downside of having light, whether that's light coming in from street lamps, or whether it's light because you've kept your TV on, or whether it's all the little, you know, flickering Wi-Fi lights, smoke alarm lights that we have everywhere now. But this is a study that came out of Australia about 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And in fact, these guys have just done another study, which isn't published yet, but they told me that women seem to have a greater need for complete darkness. There's a theory. This isn't their theory. This is a theory of someone else I spoke to. And she said she thought that if you went back hundreds of years, women often spent their nights in caves where we were safer. We were safer with our offspring. So the men would be outside up by the fire, and we would be in pitch black in caves. So there seems to be possibly some biological reason, some evolutionary reason, that we need the darkness. And yet women are really, really uncomfortable now in darkness, which is partly because we live in such a lit up world. You know, our cities are completely saturated with light day and night. It's almost impossible if you're in a city not to have some street lamp beaming into your bedroom. So we have to be particularly vigilant about keeping that light out. The way that this is starting to spin out is through breast cancer. And although the first oncologist to spot this was back in the 1970s, and he said, look, if you look at all these areas where the light is very bright, and you have to remember 50 years ago the light was nothing like it is today, if you look at the areas where the lights are very bright, those are the parts of the world where breast cancer is on the rise in the most accelerated way. So that link is now widely, widely known and talked about. So particularly breast cancer. There's a theory that it's because melatonin, the antioxidant power of melatonin, is very good at fending off breast cancer and destroying breast cancer cells. So it may be that when we have this light coming into our bedrooms, or lights on all evening, you know, we're in front of screens and it's just light and bright light. And again, with screens, the light is right close to our face. So television sets that our parents and we watched, you know, years ago, they were often at the other side of the room. They weren't nearly as bright. But screens, if someone is binging on Netflix and they've got a screen right here, and this could be going on for hours, that seems to really disrupt the melatonin. And it seems that the melatonin is possibly what is preventing breast cancer. So women need to be, I think, particularly careful about that.
Gosh, it explains so much, because I have spent my life going to new environments like a hotel room or a friend's house, getting like face cloths and t-shirts and hanging it over the fire alarm light, disconnecting all of the televisions and anything that has a little red buzzing light going on. I mean, it takes me 5 to 10 minutes to dismantle a room ready for me to sleep. And I'm sure there's women listening to this who are probably going to go and tell their husbands, their partners, whoever the men in their life, see, there's a reason why I have to do this. And it is, it does tend to be women who have this need for complete darkness. We wear the eye masks and we, you know, demand the blackout curtains. It makes a lot of sense.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Serotonin also has a play in all of this. And I think it goes back to that creativity piece, doesn't it? Because the change in serotonin at night creates a certain type of melancholia, which I feel I am able to access via my writing when I do in fact get up in the middle of the night to write. Can you explain that piece?
Yeah, so there's a lot of hormonal change that seems to be tied to light and dark, which we scientists are still only starting really to understand. So when the light drains out of the sky, we already know that our bodies change in all sorts of often quite subtle ways. So we shed more skin. I think we shed most skin at midnight. You know, our blood pressure falls, our temperature falls. So there are all these strange things happening, which again are sort of evolutionary, really. And many of us designed to sort of keep us safe. So our appetite will fade away. We stop producing, or we start producing a hormone called leptin, which stops us feeling so hungry. And the idea is, the thought is that is because in the past, if we got out of our cave and went foraging because we felt hungry in the night, we were more likely to be killed. So a lot of this is, you know, it's quite primal, really. It's a sort of version of ourselves that was adapted to a society we no longer live in, but it's still kicking around. So serotonin, interestingly, which, as you know, sometimes called the happy hormone, it keeps us sort of cheerful and upbeat. Serotonin just falls away completely during the night. And so does cortisol. And cortisol is often thought of as a stress hormone, but cortisol also keeps us sort of alert and energetic. And that is at its lowest point, I think, also at around midnight. So these hormones fall away. So people often awake at night will think they think they're awake and sort of ruminating. They think they're depressed. But it's not depression. It's just that your cheery day hormones have faded away. So it's more of a wistful, melancholy is a great word, because it's a slightly melancholy time. And I think, you know, if you're awake at night, I think you have to lean into that, rather than thinking, oh, I'm depressed, this is terrible, I must get back to sleep. You know, if you can't get back to sleep, and I would always say to someone, you know, try and get back to sleep if you can, because obviously we should all be sleeping, really, or at least for some of the night. But if you can't sleep, that is, I'm completely with you on that. I think it's your body and your brain telling you that there's something that needs, as a question that needs an answer, there's something that needs to be processed, and perhaps even suggesting that night is the time that you do that. Because you're wired differently, because you're less judgmental, because you're more creative, because you're more open to new ideas and new sensations. And that's often a very good time to... So a problem that you've been grappling with during the day, I quite often now will park them. And when I wake up in the night, which I still do rather too often, I will then sort of retrieve that problem. And I will find sometimes I'm just thinking about it in a completely different way. So there's some hormones during the day are neurotransmitters, cortisol and norepinephrine. During the day, they're really good at keeping all our different brain regions very separate. So when they fall away at night, the brain sort of becomes more loose, more fluid. We sort of dip in and out of memories more easily. I think of it as if you've got a dormitory of kids and your mum and dad are there. The kids all stay in their own beds. Mum and dad leave and the kids are all hopping in and out of each other's beds, having pillow fights. You know, it's just a different version of oneself that I found really interesting. And I think I'm really empowering to encounter, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. I think it creates, as I mentioned before, that looseness where the different parts of your brain can feed off each other. And that's what creates the creativity. I think you also refer to the production of endogenous hallucinogens, like a version of DMT, which of course would explain why we can get quite wild imagery happening at night.
Yeah, so the tryptamine is really interesting because I think a lot of people, most people I would guess, don't know that we produce this. All plants, animals, and all human beings, we all make small amounts of this. It's really hard for scientists to measure it because it tends to hang around for a really short period of time, so like 20 minutes, and it's gone. So that's made it really difficult for the research community to get a grip on it. And in fact, when you go through all the DMT papers, I mean, they're just a crazy, oh my God, they're so, first of all, actually, there aren't that many of them, but they're so disordered. And no one can really find any sort of clear rationale for why we have it, when we have it. But the scientist I spoke to who looks at DMT, he said that he thinks it is circadian and that it comes at night and that it's one of the facilitators in dreaming. So because it's a hallucinogen, it means that we can move into this sort of parallel universe, whatever you want to call it, hallucinatory world, much more easily, and then use that as a dream mechanism to resolve all sorts of whatever's on our mind. So I think that when you wake up in the middle of the night, there's quite a large chance that you've got, you maybe sort of have more DMT sort of floating around in your brain. And if you ever have those hypnagogic hallucinations, which I don't know if you have them, but they're when you're sort of drifting between sleep and wake and you have these sort of images come to you, and they come to you like a still from a film. So they're not moving and they don't have a narrative like a dream, but they just come as an image from nowhere. And you usually can't make any sense of them. But I had a lot of these when I was going through my sort of grieving and bereavement insomnia. And DMT also seems to peak in periods of psychosis and in periods of extreme stress, which are often also, of course, the times when you're awake at night. So, you know, during those times, you are subject to all sorts of biochemicals and hormones and things that perhaps you might not normally be subjected to. But I really got very attached to my hypnagogic hallucinations because they were very distracting. They were so bright. They're really colourful. They're really bright and they nearly always have people or animals in, and they just come and then they go. Generally, you don't remember them. But if you do have them and then you write them down, you can try and sort of imprint them on your memory somehow. But again, they may explain why we think differently at night.
I think I also read that women tend to have more of this chemical in their brain as well. Is that right?
Scientists think that they do, particularly pregnant women and breastfeeding women seem to have a lot of DMT floating around. And again, we don't know why. Was it a mechanism for helping women get through the pain of childbirth? There are just no answers, but it's really fascinating. I wish someone would do some really thorough research into it because it would be interesting to know. Why do we have it? Why do we have it anyway?
I'm wondering whether it's related to spirituality, with women often being the custodians of spiritual traditions. And up until recently, women were the witches. They were the shamanic kind of leaders. And I'm wondering if it's related to that women have always been the nurturers of that kind of information. And so having access to it, you know, goes hand in hand with that. I don't know.
It could be because DMT, it's also been linked to all those things that we don't really understand. So, you know, out-of-body experiences, some of those transcendent experiences where people go into altered planes of consciousness, often those seem to be linked to having a particularly abundant DMT at that point. So there's definitely, I think, a connection between this biochemical we're producing and our ability to live a perhaps a more spiritual existence, even if that's just in points of time. So if you look back at the monks and nuns in the Catholic time, would always have their most, what was deemed their, well, certainly their longest and their most often deemed their most spiritual service was Matins, which took place at 3 a.m. And that was, you know, the hour of God. And a lot of people were still, who awake at night, will still say that that is when they feel closest to God and they feel at their most spiritual. And some of that, I think, is just partly down to the fact that there's no one around and it's very quiet and it's very still. But I think it's interesting to think that we may also have evolved biochemically to have this access to this more spiritual life at night, which, of course, was so sustaining for our ancestors.
And I think, yeah, that all the traditions to the idea of the dark night of the soul and these spiritual reckonings happen at night and happen in the stillness and the darkness, but perhaps also in the spiritual openness of the night and the hormones that we access in the night.
Oh, Sarah, I completely forgot to mention this guy I've been communicating with. He's a professor of circadian biology at Newnham College in Cambridge. And Newnham College is an all-female college. Anyway, I was speaking to him while I was researching the book, and then a couple of months ago, he said, come up and meet me. I'm going to tell you what I'm working on. And so I went to meet him, and he told me that he monitors his students, these are all female students, he monitors their work. So he can see when they're working on their essays. Is it during the night, during the day? He can see when they hand their essays in. So all of this didn't happen in my day, but now they seem to know exactly who's working on what when. And he said he had noticed that the students who handed their work in, work that they had done at night, handed in at night, he said their work was nearly always the best, better than the work done during the day. So he told me that, and he said that's an instinct, but he wants to do some research, so that's great. But he also told me that his other research, that's a bit further down the line, looks at women and sleepless nights, and his theory is that women have evolved to be partially sleepless, and that it's a sort of evolutionary adaptation. If we had required this 8 hours uninterrupted sleep night after night, we would never, the human race would have died out. We would never have been able to give birth or raise children. So he's done studies that suggest that women are much more resilient to sleeplessness and broken nights than men. We are much less likely to get the metabolic disease that studies keep saying, you know, the studies that keep saying, you know, if you don't sleep properly, you're going to be obese, you're going to get type 2 diabetes, you're going to get all sorts of metabolic disorders. He says that may be the case for men, but he doesn't think it's the case for women. And in fact, other studies bear this out. So when people have looked at mortality and short sleep or insomnia with men, there is definitely a link. So men that are having trouble sleeping, they probably do need to sort that out. But women, there's no link at all between mortality and bad sleep. So we seem to have a resilience to it in part in the way that men don't. So I just wanted to tell you about this. Gosh. Amazing guy still studying the female body and sleep
at All Women's College. I love that. But it's really interesting, isn't it, because only the other day I saw yet another study that told us that, you know, we're all going to die and get Alzheimer's if we don't get our 7 to 8 hours sleep. And of course, it, you know, instills panic in those of us who don't sleep that much. But that is really interesting to hear that those studies might apply to male physiology but not female physiology. And yet again, another example of another study that we take to be gospel but really only applies to one half of the planet. Well, how comforting. How comforting.
Yes, how comforting.
I mean, I've been studying French and doing all these cryptic crosswords to ward off dementia because I've been worried about my sleep, but no, I should be fine.
There was one other study on dementia that came out at the end of last year, and it showed that people who were awake in the night were 40% less likely to get dementia. And this was such a contrarian finding that I immediately emailed the professor in America and said, you've got to explain this. How can this be? This is not what we're being told. And he said, yep, that's what my study found. It found that people who were awake in the night were 40% less likely to get dementia. And he said he thinks it's because people awake in the night are actually using their brains. They're doing things like you are. You're writing, you're working, you're thinking. And that is building, you know, cognitive reserve. And cognitive reserve, that you know, sort of enhanced brain power is helping to fend off Alzheimer's. So I just don't think these studies are never as black and white as the headlines suggest. You've always got to dig in a bit, and there's always another story underneath.
Yeah. Well, that helps me sleep better at night. Thank you. But look, I'd love to move on to the granulars of your experiences now. Like, I'd love to know how everything that you learned from writing this book went on to inform how you treat your sleep now. So what have you taken from some of these women that you studied into your own sleeping patterns?
The first thing I would say is I would never, ever track my sleep. So sleep trackers, I think, are the worst thing that has ever happened, because they stop us listening to our own body and encourage us to just look at something and say, oh, I haven't had enough sleep, therefore I don't feel very good. So I didn't track my sleep before, but now I would never, ever, ever track it. So what I learned from these women is that, one, it's perfectly normal to wake up in the night. That's quite normal. Not to worry about it, and certainly not to become anxious or stressed about it. The second thing I learned was that, you know, now is actually a really good time to get up and explore this, what I call in the book, the night self, explore my night self by doing something. So before, I would always just, you know, put in an audiobook and sometimes just lie there for hours waiting to go back to sleep, and it didn't come. Now I just think, well, I'm going to get up. And what I have found is that quite often when I do go back to sleep, when I go back to bed, you know, an hour or 2 hours later, I go back to sleep.
Can I ask something on that? I'm wondering if that is because we touched on it a little earlier, this idea that these strictures around how we're meant to sleep, when we don't pass that sort of bar, we then get anxious that we're doing it wrong. And then we get anxious about not sleeping, which of course keeps us awake. I'm wondering whether part of what is going on for us is needing to get looser, needing to be more subversive, break down some of those rules. And a lot of those rules are created by men, I find. Those tracking techniques, those regulations and rituals and protocols are developed by men, and men love them. And women often find that they can't fit their bodies and their patternings to those protocols. And I'm just wondering whether there's this, you know, sort of bizarre rebelliousness that needs to happen, this freeing up of our thinking. And that's been called out to. We're being called to express this kind of stuff in the middle of the night. I mean, it's just a thought that keeps coming up in this conversation with you. And when we stop being anxious about the fact that we're doing sleep wrong, what happens then that we can actually sleep. So when we actually express all this stuff and we honour that side of ourselves, it's like, oh, we've done it now. I can fall asleep. It's time for me to sleep. You know, we can do this now.
Yeah, I love that idea. I think you're absolutely right. I think that men, and I'm talking not, you know, I'm talking sort of generically, have stopped us from exploring outside darkness. So they've made the outside quite scary. For us, we no longer want to go out walking at night, or things that actually a lot of our female ancestors did quite regularly. I was rather surprised to find that they were often out walking. So men are now kept us into the home, usually just because of a handful of particularly dangerous, unpleasant men. So they've kept us constrained to the home. They also now want to make us sleep in a certain way so that we can be super productive during the day. But actually, I think you're absolutely right. And certainly when I couldn't sleep after all of that loss, I didn't really question it, because I knew I was supposed to be awake, oddly, because I knew that those feelings, which were enormous really and overwhelming, I knew that I couldn't deal with them during the day. I could only process that grief and only find those answers at night. And that wasn't something I'd worked out consciously. It was a very instinctive thing. I need to be awake. And I didn't worry about the following day. And that's what I think stresses most women who may even think, I want to explore my night self. I'm going to paint at night. They then start thinking, but then tomorrow I'll be no good. Tomorrow I won't be able to do anything. I'll be tired and I can't sleep because I've got so much to do. So it's definitely a sort of slight female affliction. And I think I'm with you. I think we have to hear that voice and perhaps say, okay, I'm awake for a reason, not to go back to sleep. with an audiobook clamped to my ears, but actually to get up and maybe to follow whatever it is that I'm being urged to follow. As safely as we can.
I think it's about being a little bit messy, you know, and allowing ourselves to be a little bit messy. I think that would resonate with a lot of women, I'm sure, listening to this. But I interrupted. So these are some of the things that you've taken away, which I find really interesting. What else? What else have you taken away? I think I read that you have taken to going for walks at night, getting out and seeing the stars and even sleeping under the stars. How do you do that?
Sleeping outside was probably the biggest revelation of all. And it taught me that we really need to have access to that huge night sky, which it does several things. First of all, it teaches us to live with mystery and uncertainty. And I think we really need that now more than ever. I think our lives have become so small. Our lives have shrunk, really. We think our lives are huge now because we have, you know, global access to everything. But actually, most of us physiologically are spending our days, like we are now, on a sofa in front of a laptop or in front of a phone. And that your world has just become tiny. So although we think, oh, I can see what's happening in, you know, China and America, actually the reality is that our life is smaller and tighter, I think, than it's ever been. So when you go out and you sleep under a night sky, or not sleeping, whatever, when you're out spending the night under a night sky, all of those assumptions start to change about the size of the world. Suddenly it's enormous, and it's so much bigger at night than it is during the day. So during the day, often you can't see, you know, you can maybe see the sun quite a long way away, you can see clouds and planes and things, but at night you're seeing millions and millions of miles away. You're seeing stars that died hundreds of years ago. And that idea, which is sometimes called the small self phenomenon, that idea that suddenly you are very, very small, means that also I think you suddenly realize that, yes, actually you are totally unimportant. So that the small world indoors is very narcissistic. You and your screen, and God, I'm important, and God, I've got so many likes, and don't I look good in that picture? So it's small, but it's narcissistic. Nighttime is the absolute reverse of that. It's enormous, but you are tiny, and you know your ego just sort of disappears. Suddenly you're not even thinking about yourself. The idea that the night sky guided our lives for millennia, and again still does for a lot of indigenous people, the night sky showed us where we were. We could locate ourselves according to what was up there. We looked up there for the future. Now you look up there in London, Paris, Sydney, and you see a bit of sky glow. And maybe a plane, but that is such a different view from what you will have seen when you sleep out in the bush and what I saw when I slept out in the countryside. And there's something which, again, studies now show that there's something very, very calming about that huge, huge sky and our place and how it sets our place in the world in a way that a small screen indoors doesn't. Did you find that when you slept out?
Oh, yeah. For me, it's exactly that. It's a silver bullet. When I haven't slept for a very long time, the only thing that can break the cycle and get me a few nights sleep is to pack up my tent and head out into, you know, bushland, wherever I can, and sleep outside. And sure, I'm in a tent, but I have a fly that's open so I can see the sky. And of course, you get up a couple of times in the night. Quite often I enjoy getting up. I'll get up because the feeling of sitting out under the stars is just so soothing. And yeah, there's a sense of awe. It's a very spiritual feeling. I feel very grounded. And I suppose what it is, Annabelle, is a sense of belonging. You said before, we get our coordinates. We see where we are in the world. And I think that does incredible things to your nervous system in a really, really primal way. All I can say is it just works. But, you know, having a conversation like this, we can dig down into why it might be working. I think I read in your book as well, you talk about a full moon. And in fact, that we're designed, or at least from an evolutionary point of view, to be out in the full moon rather than, you know, lying there sleeplessly tossing and turning. Yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, so the full moon is so interesting. And you only have to go back to Jane Austen. Jane Austen's favourite walks were night walks under a full moon. And even 300, 250 years ago, that was party night. So on the night of a full moon, all the houses, big houses, would have parties and invite everyone because people could walk home safely by the light of the moon. But, and going back even further, of course, they were nights that people would go hunting or they would go foraging. People could just be out for much longer. So now, the latest study I looked at showed that our deep sleep is, we have 30% less deep sleep, slow wave sleep, on a night of a full moon. And we produce quite a lot less melatonin. So it's as though our bodies have adapted to be more awake and active on full moon nights. And sadly, of course, we don't take any notice of that. But I know a lot of people who say they just don't sleep very well around the time of the full moon. And that's perhaps because we should be outside. We should be outside celebrating the night or, yeah, using that light.
And walking, we've brought this up a couple of times. And I know, you know, I'm a walker. And I also know you're a walker. You've previously, well, you've written two books on it. One of them covered, I think, was it called Windswept, Why Women Walked? So you look at, you know, the sort of the legacy and the tradition of women walking and why they walk. Do you walk now at night? Because a number of the women that you looked at in Sleepless, they would go and walk at night. They'd go out into nature. They would smell the flowers that came out at night. They became experts in the bugs and so on that would come out at night. Do you feel comfortable walking at night?
I do, because of where I am. I don't in cities, so I tried it in cities. And in fact, in the book, I write about an amazing night walker who just walks cities. I tried it, and I really, really don't like walking around London at 3 a.m. But in the country, that's completely different. And but here in the UK, we don't have any frightening beasts. We don't really have snakes or bears or wolves, so it feels very safe. Although even people who live in places where they have those animals will say they don't come near you. That they're much more scared of you. But night walking for me was another revelation. So I started by going out in a group, and sometimes I still walk in a group, but I also walk on my own because at 3 a.m. when I wake up, yeah, I can't really ring up someone. No one wants to come for a walk. So I just got used to 2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m. I would just get up and I would just go for a walk. And it's such a beautiful time. I can't even sometimes find the words for what it is like to be outside on your own at 3 a.m. under the stars, just walking. You, it's so quiet. It's so peaceful. You hear sounds that you don't hear during the day. You smell things that you don't smell during the day. So our olfactory bulb, the way we smell in our nose, is much more acute at night. So you just, and also, of course, when you can't see, because I don't take a torch, I just go out and use my night vision. When you can't see, all your other senses sort of spring into action. So you can hear more acutely. You can smell more acutely. Your vestibular system, your proprioceptive system in your body suddenly reactivates so that you're acutely aware of being embodied, being in your body and having to rely completely on, you know, the senses in your feet to make sure that you don't fall or trip because you can't see. And you hear sounds from much further away. And there's a sort of physics, which I won't go into, a sort of physics reasons to do with the land, you know, heating up during the day and cooling down during the night, which means that sound travels, stays closer to the land and travels further. So it's a very different world. And there's no colour, which also, I think, strips out a whole level of visual stimulation that can be distracting. So it's quieter in visual terms, but much more rich in terms of your other senses. And these are senses that we don't use so much anymore. We don't go around sniffing. We don't really listen all that well, do we, I think, anymore. So it's really great when you think, oh, this is how my body's meant to be. And this is a sort of primal version of myself that I haven't felt before. And I really love that. Did you like that?
Yeah, totally. I love that eerie feeling and that sense of being with the animals at night. You know, in Australia, there are quite a number of marsupials that mate at night, that do a lot of their courtship at night. And you just hear all the little noises, you know, of them going about their thing. And they're kind of largely unperturbed by me as a solitary human, just sitting there observing it all. And that relationship it feels very original. And I feel that, yeah, the way that you have reframed insomnia, you've reframed it as something that is a returning. It signals an opportunity to return to an original primal version of ourselves that I feel we really miss. I feel that our bodies are crying out for it. And Annabelle, I don't know, perhaps the rise in insomnia, sure, it's got to do with stimulation and night lights and watching Netflix till all hours and so on. But perhaps it's also our kind of crying out to ourselves to return to that version of ourselves. You know, it's the thing that's like potentially going to get us to reconnect with what we want to be reconnecting with. And I think that's an interesting idea. It's a very interesting way of framing something that we find distressing and we've been told we should be anxious about and we should be fixing with, what do you know, a drug owned by a large pharmaceutical company. I love the kind of sticking the two fingers up aspect to it all, the subversiveness of being somebody who doesn't fight insomnia but rides with it, you know. I think it's a really beautiful idea, and I have to thank you so much for bringing it to us and putting so much work into that book. It's helped me enormously. The reframing has really opened me up to, I guess, a version of myself, but also a version of my creativity that I'm now able to embrace. I'm writing a new book at the moment, and I struggle at times to access that openness, that real spiritual, melancholic, or appreciating self that you need to access to write a book, which is not to say I'm going to stay up all night, but I'm certainly going to be stressing less about being awake at 3 a.m.
Oh, I'm very glad to hear that. Because you are right that, you know, we do need to sleep, and I don't want anyone to start setting their alarm clock for the middle of the night. You know, if you're sleeping all night, that's great, but if you're not, I just think that it is quite possibly there's a reason for that, and it's not necessary that you need a very expensive new mattress, or you know you need to go and get medication, or that you need a tracker. It's that some part of you, or something in your mind, needs to be unpicked or examined or looked over or understood, perhaps with that night brain. So, well, I'll come over to Paris and we'll have a cup, like Samuel Pepys, I'll come and have a cup of tea at 2 a.m.
Let's do it. Or better still, in the countryside, either in the UK or somewhere in France. Let's go and lie under some stars together. That'll be wonderful, Annabelle. Thank you very much for joining us. That was a wonderful conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you for everything that you do.
The blurb that I wrote for the book sums up how I feel at the end of this conversation with Annabelle. So the blurb went, "This book asks one of the most beautiful questions a big soul can ask herself. What if our insomnia was a wondrous, life-thriving thing? As a reader, we answer it together with weary but deeply fulfilled relief. Yes, yes it is." Now, there were all kinds of things that came up in this conversation that we can remind ourselves of, I think, when we find ourselves sleepless in the middle of the night. So our ancestors did not, in fact, sleep 8 hours straight. And the reason that we feel we should, and the reason we then get stressed about it when we don't, is because of the big sleep industry, the capitalist-driven profit motives of the multi-billion dollar sleep industry, but also because of the post-industrialist complex itself. When we refuse to buy into this imperative, we can then loosen up and see insomnia differently, and then use it to support our creative and awe-seeking and nature-loving side. Now, the reason you might feel depressed when you do wake in the middle of the night, well, that's just your happy hormones dropping off. That's all. And it's more of a melancholia that can be helpful for creating, but also for processing grief or hurt or pain from the day. The reason you might feel rage, again, it's hormones. It's also why there are so many unhinged social media utterances in the middle of the night. And if you have a predisposition to breast cancer, well, you might want to go and invest in some blockout blinds. If you're a creative, or if you have a spiritual or philosophical yearning, you might want to take all of this as an invite to play with ideas and expressions if you can't sleep, and to enjoy the subversiveness. If you're feeling disconnected or lost in the world, try going for a walk or lying out under the stars for an hour or two in the middle of the night. And as a broader take home, I love what Annabelle shares at the end of the conversation about how embracing our awake hours, being more connected to the night, helps us to access and to get okay with the mystery and uncertainty of the world and our smallness, which is an antidote to the narrow, life-shrinking narcissism of our times. Okay, I hope this conversation brought some peace, perhaps some expansiveness and relief to all of you insomniacs out there. It's very possible that your frustrating sleeplessness is your creative original self calling out to you, and that your insomnia exists for a really, really good reason, and that it might just be cured by being honoured and listened to. So I invite all of you to share this episode, of course, with another insomniac in your life. I'm sure it will bring great relief to them too. And as always, I issue the invite to stay wild. I'll see you next week.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.